On behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, I would like to turn the call over now to Ms. Annie Beigel.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Annie Beigel, Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers, the New York State Smokers Quitline, I want to welcome you to today's conference call, Practical Issues in Applying the 5As, with our featured speaker, Dr. Jeffrey Williams from the University of Rochester Medical Center, Center for Community Health. The 19 New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers who sponsor these conference calls, they provide training and support with hundreds of healthcare providers across New York State to support tobacco dependence treatment among patients who smoke. Their focus is you, the healthcare clinician, because in any given year, about 70% of all smokers will visit a healthcare clinician. In New York State, that means that this year, healthcare clinicians will encounter approximately 1.7 million smokers. And this presents an opportunity that we cannot ignore. Because when the healthcare provider identifies and assists their patients who smoke to quit, those patients have a much better chance of succeeding. Many provider offices are very busy with multiple patient providers priorities. So on today's call, Dr. Williams, a practicing physician and researcher, will share some real-world insight into providing tobacco dependence treatment within the busy office setting. And for today's call, we are pleased to offer continuing education hours, including CME, CEU, OASIS clock hours, and CRCE. And to fulfill the requirements of continuing education credit, we are required to disclose the following. Dr. Williams has received speaker fees from Pfizer. No commercial support has been received for this program. Dr. Williams will be discussing combination medications as recommended in the Public Health Service Clinical Practice Guideline, Treating Tobacco Use and Dependence, 2008 update. The FDA-approved product labeling does not reflect recommendations in the Public Health Service Clinical Practice Guideline. So to obtain continuing education credits, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms, which are posted on the website. Please remember, applications for credit will not be accepted after May 14th. That's a week from this Friday, so please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible to get your credit. And now it's my pleasure to hand the call over to Dr. Jeffrey Williams. Dr. Williams?
Thank you. It's my pleasure to have the chance to talk with you all today about one of my passions and favorite things to do, which is to work with people around tobacco dependence. I find it interesting, and we're going to cover a whirlwind tour of the 2008 guidelines. You probably are familiar with these, but I'll try to make a couple of specific points, particularly that relate to practical use of them, and specifically getting to the second part of the program about use of combination medications. And as was mentioned before, the medications are not approved for combination use by the FDA, so that means you're using them in a clinical way to deal with symptoms that have not been adequately dealt with a single medication is one way to look at it. And then I'll touch a little bit in the last part about issues of motivation. I think that this is important for us as clinicians because oftentimes we get discouraged when we don't see high quit rates. So there may be some perspectives within that, and that relates to my area of research, which is about motivation and my personal experience. So we're going to start with the slides, the practical issues of applying the 5As. You see the second slide includes my disclosure statement. I will answer questions if you have them about that. But the goals are going to be to go on slide three, understand the public health service guidelines, discuss evidence-based combinations, and address practitioner needs. The model that we're suggesting that you use is the 5As, which is to assess tobacco use and relevant risks, a clear advice statement to quit, check with the smoker if they are if they're willing to set a quit date. And here, about 70% of smokers will say they want to quit, but only probably 20 to 30% in a primary care setting will be ready to set a quit date within the next 2 or 4 weeks. And you also want to check to see if they're willing to go for intensive treatment. If they are, they can be referred to the quit line or to a place where they provide more time, or you can set up your own intensive treatment. This intensive treatment is defined as 4 visits or more, 10 minutes or more per contact, total time. The math won't add up here, but the total time is looked at as at least 30 minutes of contact time. But if not, you'd work with them in this 2-visit model using the 5 A's. And then assist them in a quit attempt, and that includes arranging their briefly about their quit attempt, prescribe medications, and arrange for follow-up. You're looking for a contact about how they're doing within the first week after the quit date, and then at about 1 month is typically where I'm reassessing and talking about medications and seeing how things are going. Next slide. I'm sure this group is very well informed. There are 25 separate diagnoses that men are at risk for, and about 50 women are at risk for from smoking. This has to do with a bit about the rationale for why this is important, but when I look at tobacco interventions relative to other things that I do in medicine, this is the one that has the greatest impact on regaining life years that would be lost on average across the population. So the average smoker experiences about 14 years less of life expectancy than a non-smoker. And if they quit, they regain many of those years. So that's part of the messaging that I try to deliver around advice and reasons why I'm taking the time. The sixth slide I include because of we have results from the Inner Heart study. There are about 27,000 individuals followed worldwide over 50 countries at onset of first acute myocardial infarction, and the impact of tobacco use increased that almost threefold in the odds ratio. But the new information here was that chewing tobacco also doubled the risk for first heart attack, and when they used both, that incremented the risk for cardiovascular disease up to 4 times. And I think that's important because we're seeing more pressure from the tobacco industry to encourage people to chew or to use non-smoked forms. And in fact, a lot of people will get hung up using both. And so it's going to be important to be aware of that. And this is the first evidence that we're strong evidence that we're seeing that chewing also raises risk for heart disease. Environmental smoke is also important to check for. I think that the message here is that exposure even to small amounts of smoke raises the risk for heart disease pretty considerably, pretty dramatically. It's a nonlinear increase. And the message to people is that they really need to get away from smoke completely in order to reduce their vascular risks. The same is true for cancer risks, but it's particularly true for the vascular diseases. And when they do that, after 12 months of not smoking, their risk for heart attack has fallen in half. And that's outlined from a motivation perspective. When I talk with patients, I like to talk about the benefits they get from quitting. And so this is a nice list. I'm sure you've all seen this. Particularly, I emphasize in my practice the risk for heart disease, whether it's primary or a secondary event, and stroke risk falls in half within about 1 year of stopping. So that's going to be target, but you can see the other time frame here. Now, the next slide, 9, is really one to focus a little bit on because it is the it's the cycle of addiction and withdrawal. So people smoke for pleasure, enhanced performance, self-medications to reduce withdrawal symptoms, and to regulate their mood. So a pack-a-day smoker inhales about 60,000 times over the course of a year to titrate their nicotine levels to a place that helps them concentrate. It calms them down, and it gets them high. And the nicotine only takes 10 seconds to get to the brain, so in the form of a cigarette. So they like that a lot, and the half-life of nicotine is only 2 hours. So they develop tolerance very rapidly within smoking a few cigarettes, and this 2-hour half-life leads to, if they don't smoke in about 2 to 4 hours, they start feeling depressed, irritable, anxious, anxieties experienced by 90% of smokers when they withdraw, difficulty concentrating, and craving. So I remember those as the top 4. The reason that this is important is that when you get into you working with someone who smokes a great deal, so 25, 30 is a heavy smoker, 30 cigarettes per day, they're getting between they're getting between 30 and 45 milligrams of nicotine, and all the medications work by reducing these symptoms. So if you're going to consider a combination medication, you want to find out if they have anxiety, irritability, trouble concentrating, and cravings while on one of the medications. That indicates that they're either not taking enough of it or that they have withdrawal in excess of what that medication can provide, and it sort of gives us a clue clinically about when to add and talk with them about a second medication. It also takes about, for most people, 8 weeks for this syndrome to go away. It falls over the first week, and then after 3 weeks, there's probably a noticeable decrease in this, but they can get symptoms out to 8 and even 12 weeks where they still feel some of the withdrawal. And a stress experience can bring this syndrome back to them and drive them back to want to smoke again. Slide 10 is just about some genetic differences. I like to remind people that this is not the choiceful behavior that the tobacco industry would like everybody to think that this addiction is that there's a heavy genetic influence in the initiation of smoking, particularly for women, and for difficulty in quitting. Now, the initiation of smoking relates to nicotine receptor configuration in the ventral tegmental area. The difficulty quitting has more to do with the rates of metabolism. Those are the liver genes relate to some difficulties that people have in trying to stop. And so they have inherited vulnerabilities, and the tobacco industry targets them to get them to start smoking before they really, as teenagers, before they may be able to fully appreciate what they're going to be facing. So our public health service guideline recognizes this as a highly significant threat. Less than 50% of physicians spend time significantly in structuring a quit attempt in that assist portion of the discussion structure a quit attempt within the next 2 to 4 weeks and to recommend medications. And I haven't seen data on the percentage of people that get combined medications when they have leftover withdrawal symptoms. And we have effective interventions. So I'm going to talk about the guidelines. Actually, we've put in all the 10 major guidelines. This is a wonderful document. I recommend that you read the evidence base. Each one of these has an A level of evidence for recommendation on them. I'm not going to read each of them, but you have them here in case you want to review them and can find a document online. Slide 15 particularly identifies the 7 first-line medications that you would use to initially treat someone, even a heavy smoker, to see if these stop those withdrawal symptoms. If they don't, if they relapse on that, you have the option of switching to another of the medications or a single medication, or you can consider going to combination therapies. And I'll come back to that a little bit later. But these are bupropion, gum, inhaler, lozenge, nasal spray, patch, and varenicline. Slide 17 is the second of the key recommendations. It's very important that clinicians and healthcare delivery systems set up ways systematically to remind us to do this intervention. If you use the vital size stamp on slide 18, we triple the rate at which we do this intervention because we become more aware in our busy day that we're dealing with someone who uses tobacco. Slide 19 is just a quick schematic about how to use and identify is the person willing to quit now. That's really what you want to do, provide appropriate treatments or motivation to quit if they don't. And if you have someone who's quit, do a little bit of relapse prevention. Okay, so I've summarized with slide 20 on the 5 A's again. Slide 21 identifies a quick way to structure a quit attempt. So it's called STAR. This is, again, from the guideline and specifically comes from some writing of Michael Fiore, who's the leader of the guideline. You want them to set a quit date, negotiate within 2 weeks, ideally. If you go I go up to 4 weeks with that. After that, I think that their motivation and focus often falls off. I'll still let them if they want to set a quit date outside of that, but if they don't choose something within that, I'm asking them, are you willing to try it a little bit sooner? Let's try to get to this and see how it goes. Ask them to tell others about their plan and to anticipate challenges. The way I ask that is, what are going to be the most difficult cigarettes for you to give up? It's usually the one in the morning, around meals, or associated with seeing friends, or maybe with having a drink. But I have the smoker identify that. Smoker has imprinted into their life in different ways, and so I'm doing that in a very patient-centered way to find out what we need to tailor the treatment to, and to remove all tobacco products before the quit attempt.
Okay.
Use of medications. On this slide 22, I think one of the important things is that about 20% of smokers actually use a replacement medication or use a pharmacotherapy to assist them in quitting for quit attempt. And that's in part because they think that the nicotine is harmful for them. And so it's important to check with them and see if they're afraid of that. Typically, we underprescribe to reduce these withdrawal symptoms, and smokers then take less than what we actually prescribe. And so you want to check for that to be sure that they're encouraged to use the treatment. It's designed to make them feel more comfortable as they work on the behavioral issues to undo the tobacco from their life. Slide 23, the 10 key guideline recommendations. Counseling and medications are effective when used by themselves. But the combination is really the key to having an increased quit attempt. These work independent of one another, the counseling and the medications, and they're additive. And you'll see that in the meta-analyses tables that are provided on slide 24 and then 25. So counseling alone and then adding medication increases the long-term cessation, and medications alone with then counseling added also increases that. And that's over a good number of studies. We should have some reasonable confidence in that this is going to, that they work in an additive fashion. And one of the things that this guideline particularly emphasized. Slide 26, again, is about the medications. About 90% of medications, of patients, would qualify for use of medication, but again, only about 20% are using them. And there are specific places. Pregnant women are not recommended to use medications. Smokeless tobacco users, we don't have evidence, although I've seen one trial now that shows a successful medication intervention with the smokeless tobacco user. But it's not in this guideline. Light smokers and adolescents, we don't have evidence for yet. Slide 27 are the medications again. And so slide 28 gives you the odds ratios for each of the medications. And these are compared to placebo, and that's for individual meds. We don't have lots of evidence on head-to-head comparison, but we do have a bit of that. But in general, these double to triple quit rates, that's why I recommend people use them. I also say it makes them feel more comfortable to reduce their suffering as they try to quit. That's the intention. If patients even today who I see who expect these medications to stop them from wanting to smoke, and that in general doesn't happen. I go by patient experience, and smokers get about 1 to 1.5 milligrams of nicotine per cigarette they smoke, and that'll help us calculate some of the dosing later on. So people you may not want to use meds with, if they're smoking fewer than 10 cigarettes per day, I make them document that when they stop, they get withdrawal symptoms before I offer them meds. Again, irritability, anxiety, trouble concentrating, and cravings are the four that I go over. And some of the other contraindications. I'm on slide 31 now. One of their concerns is increased cardiovascular risk, and we don't have evidence for that. But you don't want to prescribe this in general within 2 weeks of an MI in the face of a serious arrhythmia, worsening angina, or accelerated hypertension. So those are things to avoid the meds with. And combination therapy has been shown to be more effective than placebo or single patch. This is where I wanted to get to on slide 33. This is the meta-analysis. There's 2 to 3 study arms that have been compared now to the nicotine patch, and we see that there really are the patch and NRT, either gum or nasal spray combined, increases quit rates, and the patch plus bupropion can increase quit rates above that of the nicotine patch alone. I will mention varenicline alone has also been superior to the patch. So So the ways that I typically use this, and then I'm going to stop and see if we'll get some questions about this, is typically if a patient comes in, for me, if they're smoking 25 cigarettes or more, I'm thinking it may be likely that they're going to, they may require a couple of medications, but if they have not tried the individual medications, then I ask them to do that first. I will frequently recommend something like use of the lozenge or the 4-milligram gum or the nasal spray where we can get into the kinds of doses. So, again, someone smoking a pack and a half, that's 30 cigarettes per day, will be getting between 30 and 45 milligrams of nicotine. And the 21-milligram patch may not cover all those withdrawal symptoms. They may for them, but oftentimes that person, when I call them in the first week, still has leftover cravings, anxiety, and so forth. And so we're left with trying to provide, are they going to make it or do they need additional support? And I'll let people go 2 to 4 weeks trying to make something work before I'm really going to come in and make another recommendation. But if they're really suffering with that, I will consider trying to adjust that to cover more of their withdrawal. So in essence, what that would mean is I would be having them continue the patch, but they might add 3 pieces of the nicotine gum around their favorite times that they smoke. Just go ahead and use those, and another 3 pieces that they would use as needed when they're getting cravings. And so they're adding about 12 more milligrams of nicotine to that 21-milligram patch. Now, remember, this is off-label. So my recommendation is what's important about this is that you document this in your chart. That's the way that you use the you use your clinical intuition and document when a person is not being successful with this and when you feel you may need to go higher on the dosing would be typically how I'm trying to work through this. And then checking back with them to see whether, when they increased the dose, did that reduce their cravings, anxiety, irritability, and trouble concentrating. So, this is the place where I want to stop and see if we have some questions.
Okay, if you have a question, please press 0 then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, first in queue we have Helene Benjamin. Helene, your line is open.
Yes, I'm confused about no medication for people that smoke under 10. My experience is that a lot of those people, because that could be like 9, that unless they're only smoking a few, they often report strong cravings, and our practice is to give them, you know, either patches or gum or lozenges when we have them. So I'm confused.
Yeah, well, I think it's a great question, first of all. And I think that the guideline has stated it this way because those people generally are not studied in the pharmacotherapy trials. So it's a lack of evidence. It's not that it might not work, but that the studies just don't include them. So most of the studies for the validation studies for the medications start either with people with 10 or more cigarettes, but most of them have done smoking, where people getting into the studies have been smoking 15 or more cigarettes per day. I think what you're doing sounds great. The only addition that I would say is that there are some people that do not have withdrawal symptoms, and if they don't, it's hard to figure out how the medications are going to help them quit, maybe more about changing their behaviors. But if I document the withdrawal symptoms, you're going to get sick of hearing me say them, but anxiety, irritability, trouble concentrating, cravings are the ones that I look for, and I teach my patients to look for these. That's when we can offer them some relief with this. And then using those meds that you outlined sounds like a great idea.
Okay, thank you.
Don't forget the behavioral plan, though, on that.
Oh, That we know, because I run the Queen's Hospital Quit Smoking Program. We have support groups. To me, that is the most important, but I do recognize, I always, you know, respect that people often do have cravings when they're under 10.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Next in queue, we have Patricia Folan. Patricia, your line is open.
Oh, hi, Dr. Williams. My question relates to varenicline. Many of our patients are using that, but at the same time, they are using nicotine gum or nicotine lozenges, even though it's not recommended. I was wondering if you have this experience with your patients. The patients that we have that do it actually do very well, and sometimes after the 6 months of varenicline, they will stop that and then just continue using, a small amount of nicotine replacement. But while they're on the varenicline, they're using it as well.
Again, a great question. The varenicline was developed as a blocker of nicotine on that ventral tegmental nicotine receptor. So it has a much greater affinity and a longer half-life, so it has an antagonistic effect with nicotine. And
right.
So theoretically, you don't think it's going to be beneficial, but nicotine acts actually on every nerve in the body. There are nicotinic receptors. And so we don't know all of what goes on. I think that the recommendation not to use it together had more to do with both nicotine and varenicline's major side effect is nausea. And varenicline, about 30% of people in the studies developed nausea, mild nausea, that tended to go away. But if you add nicotine to it, which the principal side effect for that is also nausea, people, they had a small sample of people that used the patch and varenicline, and they got into that high level of nausea where they couldn't tolerate it pretty easily. And so it doesn't have that recommendation. And that's the reason why, I think those two reasons is why you see it. I don't know of any data, no systematic assessment of people who actually go ahead and use this, although I hear about it in the background. I've had a couple of my patients go ahead and use that. I didn't recommend it, but I did note that they were. And some of them found it to be preferable, and they not everybody got the nausea, but that's all sort of anecdotal experience. And the starting it after stopping the varenicline, I don't think there's any issue with that. I think that there are a group of people, maybe related to those genetics, that are susceptible to long-term withdrawal sorts of symptoms or discomfort in their life without nicotine. And moving to longer time spans of nicotine replacement when they document they need it, when life is better while using this, it seems appropriate to me, although not systematically studied.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your take on it because we come up against this a lot. And like you say, if the patient's experience is good, we've kind of like gone with that and with them. But we don't recommend the patch ever with the varenicline, but like I said, the gum and the lozenge seems to make a lot of people comfortable. So, all right, thank you.
Okay, next in queue, we have Dr. Aubrey. Dr. Aubrey, your line is open.
Yes, thank you. Well, that was a wonderful presentation, and congratulations to Dr. Williams for having done such good work. We here in Syracuse are working on evolving a smoking cessation program targeted to pregnant ladies. And, of course, we realize that the preventive medicine services, public services, have recommended that reported that there's no advantage to nicotine replacement or other medications over and above counseling. And so we're certainly stressing counseling. But the recent evidence in support of the high relationship between depression and smoking leads us to wonder whether or not bupropion would be something that might be especially helpful in people that are not responding to the counseling, despite the fact that they're pregnant. So I wanted to know your opinion about that. And second, briefly, is there some strategy that's especially recommended in the postpartum woman, particularly in the face of breastfeeding?
Okay, great questions. I have to say that I'm an internist, so I don't treat a lot of women who are pregnant and are trying to quit smoking. I'll give you sort of the party line within the guideline, which is that None of the medications have evidence that they increase quit rates. And so without positive evidence, it's very hard to make a recommendation. Nicotine itself is known to be a teratogen, and it results in cleft palate abnormalities, other musculoskeletal limb abnormalities. And so there are some known consequences of use of this. And so what the guideline says is, first of all, that the person's own OB practitioner is most effective at delivering a 10 to 15 minute intervention with them around tobacco and structuring a behavioral quit attempt. If the woman comes back and is smoking after that, then the consideration for adding medications is there. But it has to be very carefully documented that you've talked about all these risks and benefits with them before that happens. The reason that bupropion at one point had a Class B warning, but it's now Class C, as I understand, but someone should check that to be sure that I'm remembering that correctly. And the reason for concern about it is that about 1 in 1,000 people has a seizure on this medication, and seizure is a very negative effect during pregnancy, considered to be catastrophic in some circumstances. And so the idea is, I believe, largely to avoid it because of that potential complication. The issue of depression with women quitting smoking postpartum may come up in a variety of ways, and I think you have to use your clinical judgment about that. That certainly needs to be addressed, and when risks and treatment for that outweigh what you feel are the risks from not providing treatment, that is. And when your patient agrees, that's the time to go forward with that. And I can't give you a lot of specific guideline about that, but we all know about this as a very important problem, and we need to track with people. That's someone I want to see quite regularly and talk with them, probably on multiple occasions, to be sure that they understand the consequences before we're going to be prescribing in that. And for me as an internist, I also am speaking with, obviously, with their OB about that, about any meds we consider. The postpartum period, I think that there's a very high relapse to smoking after delivery, and providing adequate treatment, but there are no studies, again, to show that we extend well into this period of time, but now you have both a mother and infant who are exposed to smoke. Of course, the fetus was exposed to the chemicals as well, but now in a secondhand fashion. And so there's lots of things to talk about with respect to motivation there. Again, medications are not recommended for the lactating or breastfeeding mother. I can't recall all of the amounts that are expressed into the milk, but I think it's relatively low, but the idea is to avoid those exposures for the infant as much as possible. So it's a great question. It needs more research, and I'm not sure I've provided a real adequate answer for you.
Very good.
Okay. Next in queue, we have Cheryl Murphy. Cheryl, your line is open.
Hi. I have a question to doctor. Are there any studies about diabetics with neuropathy smoking one pack per day? Are there any written benefits of stop smoking to reduce the pain of the neuropathy? I'm working with a patient, and it's, you know, it's like banging your head against a wall.
Maybe we'd have to stop your pain, too.
Thanks.
I can't point you to specific studies, but I've seen this written in several places. I just can't give you a particular citation. But in general, pain syndromes are expected to be improved when people quit smoking. So I would suggest that for your patient as a trial to find out. I can't quote you the amount of pain reduction that's there, but the overall evidence suggests that people who have chronic pain do get better control over it when they're away from the nicotine, whether the nicotine is accentuating that or exaggerating it, or whether it's the overall dysphoric mood that comes with this constant pattern of brief withdrawals and then needing to smoke again, sort of that cycle that people were in. or just if it's a general quality of life thing, that there's improvement that reduces the pain. But I would definitely make that I would make that recommendation to see what happens with your individual patient, if that's their one of their primary complaints.
The other, just a quick question, when you said you didn't recommend the patch for people who have recently had MIs, what do people do when they're in the hospital, you know, a smoker has an MI and he's in the hospital? I thought they gave them the patch to alleviate the symptoms.
Some centers do that, other centers don't.
Not recommended?
It is not recommended. That is from the package insert, not to be using nicotine replacement. Within 2 weeks of an MI. The issue is, I believe, more about initiating arrhythmias, and you're in a period of time when the myocardium is very irritable. And now, the opposite side of that is with the sympathetic drive that patients get during withdrawal may not be very helpful for the heart either. But the package insert does recommend not prescribing during that window, and we don't. I believe that varenicline now has a trial in hospitalized smokers, and I can't bring up the citation in my mind. So we might look in the literature to look at that. There are several studies looking at treatment for patients in the hospital now. There's a nice meta-analysis by Nancy Rigotti. And they didn't document increased adverse events, but we still are left with that as the label. And so that's kind of a clinical judgment for you to make.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed your talk.
Thank you.
Okay. Next in queue, we have Joanne Madonia. Joanne, your line is open.
Hi. I work with mentally retarded individuals, and a lot take psychotropic medications. And I have heard that Chantix specifically may be contraindicated because of bad dreams, hallucinations, etc. I wondered if are there any good meds that would not counteract the psychotropic meds, not be...
Yeah, well, again, a great question. It's complicated. The psychotropic meds often change their bioavailability when someone stops smoking, but it's not because of the nicotine. It's because of the parabenzamines, the aromatic hydrocarbons that are in smoke itself. And so those change... those are induce the cytochrome P450 system, and drugs that are metabolized in that way can be affected when people stop smoking. And so I always recommend with that group, Daryl Sharp, who works with me, has done some work with this, and I know there are several centers that focus into this area. I think what it means is that you need to do close clinical follow-up to be sure that you're not seeing worsening manifestations of their psychiatric illness and the symptoms that they have at the time that they quit. So that means some a little closer contact, which I think they need anyway. They need a bit more structure as they're trying to quit. So I think that's a very positive thing to look for. Now, about the dreams, all the nicotine medications with replacement are known to stimulate the dreams. That includes the patch, bupropion, varenicline. We think that is stimulated neural activity during the night when they're sleeping. Most smokers, at least until you get up to about two packs per day, one and a half, two packs per day, aren't getting up to smoke at night. Once you get above that, smokers pretty regularly get up to smoke at night. By the way, it's hard to get all of that in. There, for those others who are not smoking at night, are not getting additional nicotine during that period of time. And now if you wear the patch during the night, you're getting additional neural stimulation, and we think that may be some of the source of the dreams, as well as bupropion and varenicline, which are now available during those times as well. I have not heard of a contraindication for varenicline in that group because of the dreams, but I would I do hear about the dreams in treatment with people, and I think that if they're bothersome is sort of where I make that call and ask them if they're, you know, if they're bothersome enough, if they're really troubling for you, or if you see your patient worsening in other areas, I would move away from that medication. But as I recall, it's between 10 and 20% that may experience the dreams. It's not everybody. That's all that I would be able to say about that. And I haven't seen any specific studies in that area.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. We have a couple of more questions in queue. Next is Lori Schneller. Lori, your line is open.
Hi, this is Kathleen Lozon. I have a question about the long-term use of nicotine replacement therapy. Mm-hmm. One lady who has used nicotine gum for 3.5 years, that unusual, safe? What are your comments?
I'll give you the guideline actually discusses this and feels that long-term use of the nicotine replacements is far better than going back to smoking. And so in general, we want to recommend people taper off these meds. But if people are, when they come off of them, if life is worse, if they feel much worse without doing that, the recommendation is to go ahead. And the lung health study is the one that gave essentially the 12 weeks of intensive treatment, and they gave them essentially as much nicotine gum as they wished to choose. That's an exaggeration. They were within the recommendations about it. But some people stayed on that for 3-4 years, and they did not have adverse outcomes to it. And it may be as many as 10%, 15% of nicotine of tobacco users who will go on to use the NRTs over a longer period of time. I've had experience with patients on the nasal spray and with the gum that have become long-term users, and my discussion is really, you know, does it seem like this is time for you to come off of that? And we'll try multiple trials to see whether they're ready for it. The one person that I can think of that was 3 years with the nasal spray, eventually she decided that this was not something she wanted to continue, and actually treated her with the patch because she had trouble stopping that by herself. But we could use an intermediate level patch, and that managed her symptoms very nicely. Again, these are, I'm discussing sort of off-label uses. This is in the context of my clinical experience and in the context of the national guideline. So in summary, I don't think that there's adverse effects. If they are, they're not nearly what it is to go back to smoking. And I do recommend people come off of it, but if it's going to help them stay smoke-free, I continue to work with them about that.
I think what happens often with the long-term therapy is the one piece of gum can last for a couple of hours, so they really do get less nicotine over time.
Yeah, the polycrylex releases the nicotine to the surface as it's chewed, and there would be less available. Generally, I think each piece is recommended for about 30 minutes, 20 to 30 minutes for its use, and after that, they would have there would be less nicotine in it.
Thank you.
Okay, and the last question in queue is Richard Novick. Richard, your line is open.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a physician. What would you recommend as a protocol for seeing a patient specifically for smoking cessation, and what is the time required in the reimbursement code or reimbursement?
Each insurance makes their own decision about that, but I can outline what Medicare does.
Right. Okay.
As long as you have some other symptom that you're treating, you can't bill for this primarily under Medicare. But if they have a tobacco-related symptom or diagnosis, which are pretty widespread, so it may not be so difficult to find one, then the code is 305.1, and they divide it into intermediate time, which was 3 to 10 minutes, and then intensive, which is greater than 10 minutes, anything more than 10 minutes. I don't know what the I can't remember what the reimbursement rates are for Medicare.
That's okay.
And
what would be your algorithm for approaching this?
Yeah, well, I think there's very strong dose response between contact time, number of visits, and success. So I like to get into the intensive treatments, 10 minutes, four to eight visits. Medicare will allow four billings twice a year. So they're considering that two separate quit attempts because they know of the high level of relapse that we see. So I typically like to see someone within a week or two of their quit attempt. I'll call them or see them within the first week after their quit. That's to judge their withdrawal symptoms. And then around a month, but I have them call me and if they're doing worse or they're not succeeding. And then again around 3 months, that would be four visits, how I would structure it. And I'm really trying to problem solve with them and encourage them, see how they're doing, be positive about what effects they've had.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Sure. What I realized is I think when you get into the, there's another comment, when you get into the combination therapies, not only do I assess on a 0 to 3 point scale for anxiety, irritability, trouble concentrating, and cravings. I'm a little compulsive about this, I realize that, but I look at the addition of that. So 0 is none, 1 is mild, 2 is moderate, 3 is severe on those symptoms. And I keep track of that when I'm, particularly when I'm using any combination therapies. But I also look for signs of toxicity, which is new sweating, new palpitations, and new nausea since starting the medication. And if there, I also rate that on that kind of a scale. I'm not saying that everybody needs to do that, but if someone, I've had patients who are both withdrawing and having some signs of toxicity. And so I'm very careful about that, and I try to weigh both of those. Most of the time, it's pretty clean in separating out whether there's additional benefit. In other words, if they don't have those withdrawal symptoms, adding more medications isn't likely to help them, and it's going to be more on the behavioral side that we need to work with them. Okay, so I want to switch now to slides. I'm going to go ahead just briefly about motivation. There wasn't time to interact about this, but I'd like you to consider why you may feel that it's important to do this counseling relative to the other things that do in your practice, because I often think that this is something that gets pushed to the back. We don't treat it as if it's important and as other types of things that we're treating. Documented in the literature, there's a variety of reasons why docs don't do this. We generally... sometimes we're so busy we can't take the time even to identify when someone is a tobacco user or that they've relapsed. There's not always great comparative evidence about which treatments are more successful. We don't get a lot of institutional support for doing this, but I think that's coming on the way and improving. We all have time constraints and busy practice, and the issue of reimbursement already came up. It's hard to detect the success that we have, but I would argue that it's very important, even if you see a doubling of quit rates from 5 to 10% in your practice, your number needed to treat to prevent one person from dying prematurely is in the order of 1 in 10. This is a real substantial improvement in length of life and quality of life when someone's successful relative to the other things we spend our time doing. And, of course, we need more training about this. I'm going to skip 37, and there are some general comments, ways to reframe motivation into a more positive frame. More than half of all smokers have stopped since 1964. Even though on any one quit attempt it's relatively low, overall we're making progress. It's very cost-effective compared to other interventions. All types of clinicians can be effective and have been documented, and particularly good if we do combinations with a doc providing advice and then a nurse or a counselor providing, or the quit line providing more structuring of the quit plan. And one thing that I'd like everybody to recognize is that smokers, whether they want to quit or not, appreciate advice to quit smoking. They have greater satisfaction in the visit if this comes up and the advice is given. And we also need to support the teams out there doing that. Most smokers have made a quit attempt. I'm on to the next slide. 40% try to quit each year nationally in New York State. We're above 50% thanks to everybody's pitching in and the work of the Quit Line and the Tobacco Control Program. And effective treatments exist, which can work. I've given some data there. Cost per life year saved is the cost effectiveness. This is very effective compared to colon cancer screening, which is something that we need to be doing as well. It's just that this is even more cost effective, or coronary artery bypass grafting are the examples. And I'll end with this particular slide about medical professionalism, because it identifies our three highest goals. The importance of improving patient welfare, patient quality of life, and length of life is what patient welfare is about. Increasing patient autonomy to empower them to make informed decisions and live their life the way they wish, and to eliminate discrimination. And I think there is nowhere better than in treatment of tobacco that we work against the tobacco industry, which violates all three of these tenets. And we can work toward this by dedicating and spending a little bit more time with our patients. So I'm going to stop there and ask if we want to take, we're at a point where I probably need to turn it over to the Quit Line. So maybe we would do that and see if there's any questions at the very end.
Okay.
Is that Anthony Brown?
I think it is me. Yes, it is.
Welcome.
Hi. Hi. Thank you, Doctor. It was a great talk. I'm Anthony Brown. I'm with the Quit Line, and I want to introduce you to the new New York State Smokers Quit Line Cessation. It's an online community that we have. It's what we're calling Powered by Qunity, which is Quit New York Community. And it's really our Click to Quit program that we're really unveiling now. The program is a growing community, and it offers New York State smokers the ability to blog a report on their feelings and roadblocks or success stories. They can also use a coach's form, which is part of it, and they for tips. We have live scheduled chats with coaches, and we also have cost-saving calculators. It's a growing program, and we're hoping to add other features to this very shortly. We're constantly updating it. And the crown jewel of this program is an award-winning program from Health Media. It's called Breathe, and it's really a personalized online quit plan. The user goes on, and they step through a fairly extensive evaluation, and from it, Breathe creates a tailored and extensive quit plan, and it's sort of like having your own virtual quit coach. And it includes newsletters and email reminders to those users to bring them back into the program. We're really looking forward to filling the program and with as many people as we can as possible. This community that we have is being, as I said, updated almost daily. Some of the changes are very noticeable, and some are more for performance and keeping track of things. We're hoping to add, these are things we're going to be adding in the future to it, which are stronger video features, video quit tips, videos on medications, that kind of thing. Texting messages, so people can send text messages to their phones as reminders. And also IVR messaging to call people back into the program. And so the community was really created to provide an alternative method for cessation support to help more New York State residents, and these would be people who may not want to call for support. It's more of a cost-saving measure as well, and it sort of ties into this social network. And it also creating that tailored quit plan is key with the Breathe program as part of it. One of the other things we're going to be adding is more social network functions, so friending, messaging, that kind of thing. You can log into the program. Feel free to log in and join. It's free. And at nysmokefree.com, right on the front page there. And like I said, we'll be seeing it change and grow. In the future, we may be simplifying that address and providing another address. We will keep you updated on that. Given the fact that media resources are fairly limited, we are looking to people like you to help spread the word on this. It's free. It's a valuable service. And we are also building materials and campaign support for the marketing of this program, like email blasts, e-ads, fact sheets, testimonials, and that kind of thing. Those are in the works. We'll be sure to keep you informed on these things, these changes and updates, hopefully through the cessation centers. And I want to thank you for your time. So remember to visit nysmokefree.com to join, and look forward to seeing you online. So I'm going to send it back to you, Elizabeth. Thank you.
Okay. If you have a question, you may press 0, then 1 on your telephone keypad. First in queue, we have Nicole Park. Nicole, your line is open. Oh, she accidentally disconnected. Okay, we have Patricia Folan. Patricia, your line is open.
Actually, this is Dan Jacobson. We're sharing a line over here. I work at the Cessation Center on Long Island, and I had one question, and I wanted to give some information to the person who asked the question about diabetic neuropathy. If you go to talktoyourpatients.org, which is one of the websites set up by the New York State Department of Health, and you go under research, you'll find a lot of information under there about diabetes and smoking, including neuropathy. Secondly, Doctor, I'm a nurse practitioner. I work here at the center. We do direct cessation, and in addition, I do private practice. I had a question on when you said someone who smokes two or more packs a day or someone who smokes considerably more than a pack, you would give them a patch, a step one patch, and several pieces of gum. How I usually deal with that patient, I would give a two-pack-a-day smoker two step one patches and then have them titrate the breakthrough products like the gum or lozenge as needed. Do you have any reasoning why you do the multiple pieces of gum?
I think that has more systematic study than doubling the patches. The other issue is I certainly have worked with people who have used two patches. Again, what I want to be careful about doing is documenting that one is not enough for them and that they get relief with the second without getting some toxicity from it. And I think that you can approach it either way. I think that the reason for adding the PRNs particularly is it allows them, I have them use a certain number of them every day around and then add additional ones. So it gives them some flexibility. Not every day is the same in terms of either the stress or their withdrawal that they experience. And so there's a little bit more freedom of dosing. But if it's easier just to use the two fixed patches and they're not getting into trouble with that, again, we're off FDA recommendations.
Right, I understand.
Yep.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Dr. Williams, this is Annie Beigel. We are at the top of the hour. I think we need to bring this call to a close. So I want to thank you, Dr. Williams, for providing an excellent presentation to our participants today. And on behalf of the New York State Cessation Centers, the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program, and the New York State Smokers Quitline, we want to thank you for your wonderful presentation today. And I'll also thank all of our participants who participated on today's call. Please mark your calendars. Our next conference call is going to be on June 30th, and the topic will be how child health providers can help family members quit tobacco use. And this brings us to the end of today's call, so I want to thank you, Dr. Williams, once again, and again, thank all of our participants, and have a great day today. Thanks.